Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. You are listening to the Revolution Health Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Wright, co-author at scdlifestyle.com. This episode of RHR is brought to you by 144.me. This is a 14-day healthy lifestyle reset program. So Chris Kresser has put together a program here. If you're someone who's still struggling with maybe digestive issues, skin problems, low energy, maybe insulin issues, basically all of these conditions, all health conditions, are foundationally supported by diet, sleep, movement, and stress. Now, incorporating all four of these variables into your life can be very hard, especially if you're having to make tweaks in all of these areas at the same time. Chris knows this. He's been studying psychology and habit formation for a long time. And so what he's done is he's put together this 14-day healthy lifestyle reset program where you're going to actually work on your diet, your sleep, your movement, and your stress all at the same time. And by the end of the program, you'll have incorporated the foundational pieces you need to get over these issues. So check it out at 144.me. All right, let's get on with the show here. With me is integrative medical practitioner, healthy skeptic, and New York Times best-selling author Chris Kresser. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you, Steve? Good to talk to you. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. I'm recovering from a sinus infection.
Oh, man. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's okay. It happens when you don't do those four foundational steps.
You need a little 14-4 spring cleaning, huh?
Yeah, you try to have too much fun and do too much work at the same time.
That's not sustainable for very long. It might work for a short time, but definitely not over the long term, as you're finding out, right?
Yep. I got to make the mistake like every 3 months or so. And that's just...
Right, just to remind yourself.
Yeah, the body's just trying to train me.
Yeah, got it. Well, I hope you get well soon.
Yeah, I'm on the mend. It's all good. So what have you ate all day today?
I had scrambled eggs, sweet potato hash browns, and raw sauerkraut with cabbage, beets, and carrots for breakfast. And I had kind of an unusual lunch because I've had a lot going on and I knew we were sitting down to record. So I just had some yuca crackers from Mission Heirloom. Really awesome thing that they do. Sylvie loves them and we send them with her to school for her snack at preschool. They're made from yuca, or AKA manioc or cassava. It's grated and then pressed and dried into crackers. And I put some ghee and salt, sea salt on them, sometimes some avocado. And I had some olives, Castelvetrano olives, green olives, which are my favorite. I had some salami, some raspberries. It's similar to like a food that I take with me on an airplane, and a little bit of sliced chicken and some kale that we had left over. So it was kind of like almost like a tapas, although nothing Spanish about the food, but you know, just, in the sense that it was like a smorgasbord, I suppose.
Yeah. More like a summer picnic.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you tried the Boulder brand avocado oil sea salt chips?
No, I haven't. Are they potato chips?
Yeah, so it's just white potatoes cooked.
Oh, yeah. Avocado oil. Yeah, those are pretty good.
They're dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, certainly they're better than eating chips with industrial seed oils, and they're a great snack, but if you eat like two bags, it's probably not doing you any favors.
Probably need 14-4.
Yeah. But we have a really great question. It's from Dr. Akhil Palanisamy, I think is how you pronounce it. I hope that's correct, and I apologize if it's not. I've met Dr. Akhil before, and he's a functional medicine practitioner in San Francisco. He's got a really good question that I think a lot of folks have asked, and a lot of people will be interested. So let's give a listen.
Hi, Chris. This is Akhil Palanisamy, integrative medicine physician in San Francisco. I had a quick question for you about meat consumption and the microbiome. When I was reviewing the literature recently, I came across some studies which surprised me, suggesting that eating meat could have an adverse impact on gut bacteria and that a vegetarian diet may have beneficial effects on the gut microbiome and markers of gut bacteria. So I'm wondering if this is related to antibiotics in commercial meats that are having a negative effect on gut bacteria. I couldn't find any studies that looked at pasture-raised meat or antibiotic-free meat, and I wonder if that would have a better impact on gut bacteria. And it's a very important question, I think, because many patients that I see have a problem with their microbiome, and I'm trying to restore it. And if eating meat has an adverse impact on it, then that would really change my dietary recommendations for people. So thanks for your response. Okay.
Okay, so I'm sure some of you have seen articles in the mainstream media about this, or have seen some chatter in social media or whatnot. And it is true that some studies show that vegetarian diets are better for the microbiome, and eating meat is associated with unfavorable changes in the microbiome. But once again, have to understand the issues with most of this kind of research, and we, you know, to get like a much more detailed discussion of this, go back a few podcasts and listen to the Research 101 show that we did, where we covered all of these issues much more extensively. But most of these studies are just comparing two groups of people. They're comparing meat eaters and vegetarians, and then they look at the microbiome in each group, and then they come to some conclusion where they say, okay, people who eat meat generally have a worse microbiome than vegetarians. The problem with drawing that conclusion is that we know from other studies that the average meat eater does a lot of things differently than the average vegetarian. They eat fewer vegetables and fresh fruits. They don't exercise as much. They tend to smoke more. They consume more alcohol. They engage in all kinds of other behaviors that can adversely affect the microbiome. And studies do try to control for some of those other confounding factors, but they can never control for all of them. So what we can learn from these studies is only that the average person who eats red meat has a disrupted gut microbiome compared to the average vegetarian. That's the only thing a study like that can tell us. It doesn't tell us whether it's because of the meat or because it's the, you know, the buns that they're eating, like the hot dog buns and hamburger buns around the meat, or it's the sugar, or it's the other crap that they're eating, or it's a lack of exercise, or it's that they smoke more frequently. Those other factors are more than likely what are causing this difference. So if you extend that, of course, it doesn't mean that a person who eats red meat that is also eating a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables and fermented fibers, fermented foods, that isn't eating a lot of refined sugar and industrial seed oils, that is exercising and sleeping and taking care of themselves, is going to have an inferior microbiome compared to someone that's doing all those things and not eating meat. There is no study that I've seen that has come to that conclusion.
Yeah, and I've looked at this stuff quite a bit as well, being something I care about, and I've thought about it a lot in my diet. And so I've tried times of vegetarianism just to kind of see what it was like, and also during like my Vipassana retreat.
Yeah.
And what I think is also not being talked about in these studies, besides everything you've already mentioned, is that typically, because when you go vegetarian, you need more calories, you end up eating a larger quantity of fermentable fibers, mm-hmm. versus somebody who's maybe satisfied earlier because they're consuming animal content. They might end up eating less fruits and vegetables over time just because they need less volume to feel full and satiated during a meal.
That's true. That's definitely true. And of course, the question there is, does that adversely affect the microbiome? And I haven't seen any studies that suggest that it does. I mean, we've looked at traditional cultures that have meat in their diet, but also eat relatively high amounts of plant foods, you know, fruits and vegetables and tubers and other plant parts, and they have, you know, an ancestral microbiome. So I don't think we can say that it has much to do with the meat, but it does have to do with the other, you know, the intake of other stuff. We're going to come back to that. And also, you know, non-dietary factors like sleep and exercise, we know affect the microbiome as well. So, you know, when we hear, when people read these kinds of articles or hear about them on social media or on the news, there's a natural and understandable tendency to kind of identify with the meat eater and place yourself in that category and assume that you are, you know, in that group and are subject to those same conclusions. But it's not true, actually. Most of the people who are listening to this podcast are not representative of the meat eaters in scientific studies. That's really important to understand. So if you ever hear of a conclusion that's being drawn of, you know, red meat eaters in scientific research, you are not that person, typically. Of course, it depends on the exact study and what they're looking at. But most people who listen to this show are eating meat in the context of a very of a diet that's rich in all of the things that are beneficial for gut health. And so we cannot extrapolate the results of meat eaters in these studies to all of you who are listening to this show. So if it's not the meat, what is the biggest factor that determines the health of the gut microbiome? I think it is the type of carbohydrate that you eat. And specifically, it's the ratio of acellular to cellular carbohydrate. Now, that sounds very geeky, I know, but just give me a chance to explain it a little bit because it's a very useful concept to understand. And I think it actually explains a lot of the, it answers a lot of questions, and you'll see what I mean as we go through this. This concept of acellular versus cellular carbohydrate and the importance of it to the gut microbiome comes from one of my favorite research papers ever, which was written by Professor Ian Spreadbury. And he's actually going to be a presenter at the Ancestral Health Conference Symposium conference in New Zealand, the New Zealand version of that conference, which is happening in October of this year. And the paper was called Comparison with Ancestral Diets Suggests Dense Acellular Carbohydrates Promote Inflammatory Microbiota and May Be the Primary Dietary Cause of Leptin Resistance and Obesity. So that's a mouthful. The study will be in the show notes, so you can check it out. The full text is free, and you can read it if you'd like. But the basic idea is that all carbohydrates that were part of the ancestral diet, which would be tubers, fruits and vegetables, other plant parts like stems and leaves, store their carbohydrates in fiber-walled living cells. And those cells remain largely intact during the cooking process. And they also resist digestion or absorption in the small intestine. And therefore, the fiber remains intact all the way down to the colon, where it then becomes food for beneficial gut bacteria that are living in the large intestine. So those are the cellular carbohydrates. And they're, like I said, found in all ancestral carbohydrate sources. On the other hand, in the Western or industrialized diet, you have a lot of acellular carbohydrates. These are things like flour, sugar, and other processed starches that have no living cells. And these industrial foods are much higher in carbohydrate density than anything the microbiota of our upper GI tract would have encountered during our long evolution. And these foods, because they have no living cells, they're absorbed higher up in the GI tract, and they can stimulate the overgrowth of bacteria in the upper GI tract, aka SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And they preferentially will feed some species of bacteria over others, and that can in turn lead to an inflammatory gut microbiota. And Dr. Spreadbury makes the argument, which I agree with, that this difference in carbohydrate type could be the single most important difference between ancestral and industrialized diets. Now, notice I didn't say carbohydrate quantity, the amount of total carbohydrate that you eat. I don't think that's the issue for most people. The issue is carbohydrate quality. And I know I've been beating this drum for a long time. I wrote about it in my book. Professor Spreadbury talks about it in the paper. He points to traditional cultures like the Kitavans and East African groups who eat from 35 to 70% of calories as carbohydrate. But all of these carbohydrates come from foods with living cells like tubers or fruit or other plant parts. And the reason that industrialized diets are so harmful is not because of the overall amount of carbohydrates that they contain, as some people have argued, but because they don't have those living cells. And as a result, they have a completely different impact on the gut microbiota than the ancestral carbohydrates, the real food carbohydrates.
Is it living, Chris, or is it more of the complexity and the molecular structure of the differentiation? Because like we can take those tubers and cook them, now they're not living anymore. But I was kind of under the understanding that, you know, you have like a cell wall that contains all the parts of the cell, and it's a complex isn't necessarily the perfect word here, but the actual molecule is still intact, whereas the processed foods, the molecule has been stripped down.
That's right. Yeah, it's been pre-digested essentially and broken down. And the cellular structure, like I said before, remains largely intact even during cooking. So the carbohydrates are locked into the fiber-walled cells. And that's why in some cases the carbohydrate portion of that food is inaccessible. And that's why it's considered to be fiber. Fiber is not a nutrient technically for humans, because we can't absorb the carbohydrate that's contained in those cells and make use of it ourselves. But the fiber, those cells are instead, they're nutrients for the bacteria that live in our large intestine, because they survive in that form all the way down to the large intestine. So another way to think about it is these real food carbohydrates that come in these tubers and plant foods, especially the ones that are resistant to digestion, are not nutrients for us. They're nutrients for our gut microbiota. And on the other hand, the flour and sugar and processed starches, they are absorbed completely by us. And furthermore, they're absorbed in a different, part of the GI tract, and they feed bacteria. It can lead to an overgrowth of bacteria in that part of the digestive tract because they lack that cellular structure. And so they have a completely different impact on the gut microbiome. So, when you compare diets, if you take one diet that has 25 or 30% of calories as carbohydrate in the form of these cellular carbohydrates, the tubers and the fruits and the vegetables. And then you have another diet that's 30% of calories as carbohydrate in the form of flour and sugar. Those are going to have a completely different impact on the body. And Spreadbury's argument is the thing that's mediating that difference in impact is the gut microbiome.
Yeah, I love it. I believe it too. And I think it just makes sense once you begin to actually think about what's happening inside of the small intestine and the large intestine. Like when you really think about the structure of the foods we eat and what functionally is supposed to happen, and then what is happening from an ecosystem in each organ, it only begins to take on just really logical sense.
I think that is a good point, because we've been, talking about this for a long time, but the contribution of this paper is that it provides a clear mechanism for why an industrialized carbs have a different impact on the body than real food carbs do. And, to make it even more clear, the standard American diet is, it varies from person to person, but on average, it's, I think, 40 to 45% of calories is carbohydrate. And so, the low-carb advocates have argued that, hey, this is way higher in carbohydrate, and that's why it's problematic. Well, that's not true, strictly speaking, because there are cultures, as I said before, that consumed an even higher percentage of carbohydrates of calories as carbohydrate, up to 70%, but they didn't have any of the diseases that people eating industrialized diets are suffering from. So that goes to show that it's not about the total amount of calories from carbohydrates, it's about the quality and type of carbohydrates that are being consumed. And another line of evidence that supports that is the studies that have been done on the paleo diet so far that have shown such remarkable improvements with weight loss and metabolic health have been done on a moderate carbohydrate paleo diet, you know, ranging from, I think, 20 to 30 or 35% of calories as carbohydrate. These are not really low carb diets that are being studied. They're diets that restrict the quality and type of carbohydrates that are consumed. They eliminate, you know, grains, especially and processed and refined grains and all the dense acellular carbohydrates that are part of the industrialized diet. And they just permit intake of, you know, starches and fruits and these cellular carbohydrates. So I'm not aware of many, if any, studies on a very low carb paleo diet. Almost all the studies I've seen on paleo are, you know, 30% carbohydrate, roughly. And you're still seeing really remarkable, you know, reductions in weight and improvements in insulin sensitivity and body mass index and waist circumference and all of that stuff, which really, again, just goes to support the argument that it's more about the quality and type of carbs than the absolute amount. Now, there is one thing that I want to point out, which is that, and you kind of alluded to this before, Steve, one reason I'm not a fan of very low carb, high protein, high fat diets for extended periods of time is that when you cut your carb intake, your absolute amount of carbohydrate that you eat to be, you know, when you cut it down to like below 10% or below 7%, which can be necessary in order to achieve ketosis for some people, it becomes very difficult to consume sufficient amounts of fermentable cellular carbohydrates to maintain a, you know, a really robust and healthy gut microbiota. And I think this explains why some studies have shown that people consuming a very low-carb diet may experience undesirable changes in their gut microbiota. And we have seen this in our clinic and in our work with patients. I think we need more research in this area, but if you understand, like you said, Steve, the how the small intestine and large intestine work and how, you know, what the bacteria in the large intestine need to sustain themselves, it makes sense that if you're on a diet that where you're eating on a percentage basis, a much higher percentage of non-fermentable substrates like meat and fat, and a much lower percentage of fermentable substrates like these, like the plant foods, then it very well could have an adverse impact on the gut microbiome over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, we don't know for sure yet, but the analogy I like to use is like, if you throw a scoop of peanut butter on the sidewalk in any city, you're gonna have a giant ecosystem that forms within minutes to hours where a dog's gonna walk by, some ants, maybe a bird, maybe some humans will mess with it, who knows? And the same thing is true inside of our gut. Like everything we put into our mouth, it is gonna be part of the ecosystem. And some of those foods feed the ecosystem in certain parts of the body. Other foods feed the ecosystem lower in the body, in the large intestine, which is what we're talking about here. And so, I mean, if you just start to think about the fact that everything you put into your body is sort of feeding this ecosystem, you know, I don't like getting reductionist, but it is kind of simple once you stop to think about what, you know, we do want a robust gut microbiome and what feeds that? Well, certain types of foods and other types don't.
Exactly. And another angle or way to look at it is like, you know, in clinical practice, if I'm treating SIBO, one of the strategies that we use is a diet that's low in fermentable fiber. You know, we put patients on a diet that is low in these fibers because we know that these fibers can feed bacteria that have become overgrown in the small intestine. And, you know, this stuff is not, you know, there is a lot that we already know. We do need more research, but there is a lot that we already know. I mean, one of the treatments for SIBO, for example, is an elemental diet, which is composed of only simple carbohydrates like glucose and fructose that are absorbed extremely high up in the digestive tract and thus don't become food for bacteria lower down in the gastrointestinal tract. And we know studies have shown that people who are on elemental diets experience a dramatic shift in their in the composition of their gut microbiome. So, you know, I think you can make a very strong argument that a diet that's low in fermentable substrates and high in meat and fat may have an adverse impact on the gut microbiome over time. Now, you know, getting back to the original question, of course, that does not, you know, when we tell patients to eat a paleo type of diet, we're not necessarily, and hopefully not, telling them to just eat only meat and fat. I mean, that's not what the paleo approach is about, as we've talked about ad nauseum. We're telling them to eat a diet that is very rich in fruits and vegetables and fermentable fibers and fermented foods and things that support the gut microbiome that also happens to include meats, because meats are very nutrient dense and have a lot of other beneficial impacts on health, even if they don't have necessarily a beneficial impact on the gut microbiota. So, you know, again, to sum this up, it's not really about whether you eat meat. It's about the context in which you're eating meat, the quality and the type of carbohydrates that you're eating. You want to focus on real food carbohydrates like tubers and fruits and other plant parts that contain all of the fibers that feed beneficial gut microbiomes, microbes. This is resistant starch. We're talking about non-starch polysaccharides, things like inulin and FOS and arabinogalactans. And then we're talking about soluble fibers. All of these different types of fibers feed the beneficial gut microbiome. I know that this is anathema to some people in the paleo community, but legumes can be a really good choice if you tolerate them, if you prepare them properly, soaking them prior to consuming them, and if they don't replace more nutrient-dense sources of food, they can be an excellent... One of the reasons that they can be beneficial is they're an excellent dietary source of resistant starch, which is somewhat difficult to come by in the diet. And if you have to eat a very low-carb diet or a ketogenic diet for any reason, maybe you're treating a neurological condition, maybe you're on a rapid weight loss program, maybe you feel better doing that in most ways, I would suggest increasing your intake of fermentable fibers. Many of these are not, they don't really count towards your carb intake anyways, because the carbs in them are not absorbed. So for example, if you cook a white potato and you cool it, a lot of that will be resistant starch and it won't impact the blood sugar or carbohydrate levels as much as if you just eat a cooked potato. You can use potato starch, and that again is not going to have an impact on your overall carb level intake. You can use plantain flour or green plantains, dehydrated, green banana flour. You can use supplements, you know, non-starch polysaccharides. I sell one in my store called Prebiogen, which I really like. And then there are soluble fiber supplements, things like acacia fiber or, you know, psyllium husk is another popular soluble fiber. Glucomannan is one that I like a lot. I think I also have that in my store. It has a particularly good effect on blood sugar. And you can use all these fermentable fibers to make sure that you're not starving your gut bugs of the foods that they need to thrive over the long term. And I just had another thought along these lines. I can't remember if I've ever blogged about this. I'm sure you've seen this study too, Steve, but there's now some speculation that a low FODMAP diet, which can be very therapeutic for people with IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and also SIBO, may not be a good choice over the long term because it removes a lot of the foods that feed beneficial gut flora. And this has been being discussed now even in the mainstream scientific literature. So I find, you know, that kind of supports everything that we've been talking about today.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think the ways in which you've mentioned, and I would echo what you've seen, which is that if FODMAPs are an issue for you, you know, obviously cut them out while you fix the root causes. And that's an indication that, like, your gut is really messed up. The more sensitive you are to FODMAPs, it appears that you're having some definite issues, and then over time you want to get those foods back in as fast as possible. That's something that's bugged me about that entire thing. So that's cool that there's some research and some talk about that finally.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure there will be more. You know, we're definitely moving in this direction. Okay, so that's it for today. Keep sending us your questions. It's fun to be able to hear what's on your mind and respond to it. And I'll look forward to seeing you, talking to you next time.
Yeah, send those questions in at chriskresser.com/podcast question. And in between episodes, hang out with Chris on Facebook, facebook.com/ChrisKresser LAC or twitter.com/ChrisKresser. Thanks for listening, everyone.